Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hi, my name is Anastasia Valentine. I am the president of Resource One and managing partner based in Chicago, Illinois, and we are an information technology consulting firm.
Anastasia, thanks so much for making time to join us on the Ivy Podcast. Before we dive in and talk a little bit more about your current company, everything you're building, give us a thumbnail version of your career prior to that.
Well, believe it or not, I graduated from Northern Illinois University with a biology degree and a minor in chemistry. Wow. My very first job was an invitation to be a technical recruiter. I had decided to stay at school one extra semester, not because I wanted that minor in chemistry, but that's what my parents thought. I wasn't quite ready yet to graduate. So I had kind of a 9-month lapse before I was planning on starting medical school. Joined a company called Advanced Resources at the time under the helm of Leo Sheridan, who's one of my mentors throughout my career, and helped him open up his first information technology consulting side of his personnel business. Moved into another company as a branch manager, opened up their national IT group here in Chicago, is kind of their pilot entity. And then moved over to Resource One, where I have been here for 24 years, actually October 26th.
Oh, well, that's exciting and very diverse backgrounds. And, you know, congrats on all the success. So tell us a little bit more about what your company is all about. What are some of the competitive advantages that you guys have in your market?
Well, I was very fortunate when I started in this industry. I was given access to a student at Northwestern that was obtaining his master's degree in information technology. The first company that I joined really had an interest in working with Motorola, which at that point in time was a good amount of telephony and cellular engineering. So with that said, I used to meet with this tutor every, you know, probably 3 times a week, tearing apart motherboards, understanding semiconductors, really received a solid education in that. And so engineering is really primarily my background. With that said, as I've moved through my career at Resource One currently, that's probably where we are, where we differentiate ourselves, is that we're very much involved in the software development lifecycle, systems integration, administration, engineering. We do a lot of cloud work, Internet of Things, and quite a bit of work in database. So everything from warehousing to administration to business intelligence reporting. That's where we play. That's where we do our best business. We really don't do too much in networking or low-level operations. Most of the people that work with our firm are the primary breadwinners of their family.
Well, that's super exciting. And with the current market conditions in talent acquisition, with the war for talent being real out there, especially in technology sector, can't help but ask in terms of what are some of the strategies or practical recommendations that you implement as you work with your client companies to really succeed in this space, to be able to find very niche technology talent. What are some of the recommendations that really help you succeed in that space?
Well, I truly believe to find technical talent, you have to have technology yourself. 9 years ago, I think Resource One really took the stance that we were going to start building an aggressive technology stack. I had been fortunate enough to speak around the country at several conferences as a leader in this initiative. Many of our colleagues are starting to adopt technology, you know, in its inception today, as we're about 9 years into the stack. and gracefully moving through digital transformation. And the question is, that's never a great, you know, how graceful can digital transformation be in adult learning and migration? And that's a whole separate issue in itself. But with that said, to find the best talent, I think you need to have the best technology. In our organization, we're very lucky that we've invested a considerable amount of money in building a technical understanding with our employees. So they're able to understand the requisitions, they're able to communicate them appropriately to the talent. It just seems like it's a natural flowing process. We really are mid-market, so we stay away from any type of vendor management type of scenarios. And I think that helps attract sometimes better talent because they just, you know, they don't want to get involved in that whole, who am I talking to? What am I talking to? Why didn't someone call me back type of scenario? So we primarily specialize in direct. And the best piece of advice that I would give anybody, if you want to operate at a high level of technology, you have to invest in your infrastructure.
Right. Absolutely. With the shifts in how workforce collaborates, communicates, and just overall future of work, we've seen a great growth in the trend of future of work, in the sense also the, you know, extensive leverage of, you know, contingent workers, contractors and consultants, and the overall freelance environments. What have you seen in that particular space in terms of trends and, you know, just overall adoption of more agile, more, you know, leaner ways to be able to scale up or down for organizations? Just share your thoughts from that perspective or for companies to leverage that.
Well, I think a lot of people have the methodology that you have to hire more people to scale up, or, you know, lean your staff out to scale down. We have kind of a unique methodology in the way that we look at our business. Our goal is to have as many producers as we can at about a $7 million clip per seat, meaning like each producer here is at their minimum mark becomes about 7 million. So in our case, we have two directors of recruiting, one at 7 million, one at 8. We have salespeople that are 8 million, one at 3, one at 4. Our goal is not to hire people, but it's to bring in technology to make the producers we've invested in more efficient within their job, utilizing technology. So people always ask, well, Anastasia, how do you really understand what your ROI is in technology? And I can tell you, if you look at an average user per seat on a Bullhorn or Aviante, right? Maybe in our industry, it's a half a million to 1.5 million. It's very unusual to even have someone over the 3 million mark. So our goal is to get our whole base up into that 7 million mark. And then we start bringing in right about the 3 million, the next succession to follow in their path. It's kind of how we do it here. That's how we scale. It's about getting our current team to what we would consider close to capacity at an 80% before we bring the next succession layer on.
Right, Marion, absolutely. As far when it comes to talent retention, and there's been another layer of complexity, especially in the current highly competitive environment, in terms of the organizations that do succeed in this space and those that don't, that are able to retain the top talent, what are the differences that you observe? What are some of the, you know, strategies that you deploy as you help your companies, you know, have that competitive advantage in terms of being able to retain the top talent?
Well, it's kind of like we're talking about the great resignation, right? It's interesting. I just did a podcast regarding the great resignation a couple of weeks ago. So it's fresh in my mind. And every day I'm thinking about how I change this organization to not focus necessarily on our attrition, but focus on how we can keep people interested in staying here and employed. You know, the bottom line is, it doesn't matter how good any leader is, we're all gonna get hit with the great resignation. And the question is, how fast can you restructure your organization to continue to attract millennials and Zs? So in our case, I think we've changed our hiring process right out of the gate. We used to have the philosophy that, well, we have time to spend with somebody. So if they don't come to the table with maybe 5 out of 5 skills, if they got 4 out of 5, well, they're going to be here with us for a while. So we have time to train. Now, I think what we've come back to is I'd rather pay $5,000 to $10,000 more for the best talent. I expect they're probably going to stick around here for about 1.5 years if I truly give them a good career path. I can't change the fact that Z's and millennials will have 10 jobs in 16 years. I don't know whether or not, you know, any organization is going to be able to break that trend, but, you know, we're bringing in more resources, outsourcing training, certifications, opportunities, and learning methodologies for these individuals to stay engaged with our organization. And my hope is that maybe we get 3 years out of the, you know, 10 job changes, and that's yet to be seen. Flex work schedules, I mean, it is what it is. That was never part of the culture of our industry. It's really hard for legacies like myself to break a team and an energy of a team because we realize how dynamic it is when we work together, but it is what it is. And so we've done a better job at figuring out as a management team how we're going to adjust our management style. Adopting a hybrid has been very popular. You know, we have to manage more proactively, and that's what we're doing. And so I guess you put in all of these factors and you hope when the next year and a half comes by, right, that some of this new talent you're bringing on is going to feel that you're a worthy place to stay.
Right, absolutely. So with the way you've been in this industry for quite some time and you've seen it go through different iterations and cycles, in terms of where do you foresee the market going next as far as the trends that you're researching and observing, share some of those with us. What are the things that you're keeping a closer, you know, hand on the pulse in terms of where the market has a tendency to shift towards to?
Well, I think just starting with technology, it's almost impossible today for any company to exist without technology. So I'm lucky that I'm sitting right in what I would consider a natural progression of business today. I think that a lot of companies are going to have a really hard time shifting some of these methodologies and adopting technology to support a lot of these changes that are being mandated, you know, with little time. We're very fortunate because we're small enough that we're mobile. So we can shift, we can change. We have a good technology backbone. We can retrain ourselves how we look at the definition of success, right? Through a different lens and through adoptions of new ways of doing business is where that's really hard for some companies to shift. I think that the industry is really going to, in general, probably have a great shift. I think that companies that are adopting and have technology are really going to take the lead in some of this. You know, naturally, I worry about small businesses having the ability to afford training, having the ability to have technology implemented rapidly. You know, we really may start seeing a big divide here on how small businesses emerge into medium businesses and into large businesses. You know, are they going to have access to everything that the new generation of worker really is going to be demanding?
Right. That's a very interesting observation. The other area that's fascinating to me, and it's very complex, when I'm talking about interviewing, that's a lot of hiring managers, and myself included for a very long time, I found interviews to be flawed in a sense because a lot of that is based on your past personal experience. And instead of focusing on what's the strength that's missing on my team, there's a lot more attention or focus on what is the weakness that I can tolerate in that particular candidate when the interview happens. So what are some of the strategies and recommendations that you deploy when you help your client companies when it comes to prepping for the interviews, setting the right expectations, well, both sides, for candidates as well, in terms of being able to facilitate that two-way street conversation and, you know, improve your batting average when it comes to interviewing?
So it's interesting. We look at our close ratio very serious, and it's pretty much the terminology for what you're talking about. How, when you're brokering a skill set to a client, you're acting as an intermediary. How do we, you know, these common faux pas that happen, you know, how do we take this information and deliver it back to both communities? It's interesting. You know, we would think in the level of engineering that we're in that everybody would have command of Zoom or command of Microsoft. On the client or on the candidate side, what we find is in some of the research that I've done with SIA material, just because someone's an architect or, you know, proficient in programming or project manager, you know, a lot of these people are just as new to these various technologies as we are. So we see mistakes or fundamental mistakes happen when interviews happen. All of a sudden, someone's internet isn't working, or they can't get into O365, or there's something wrong with the link. So on the candidate side, we really have to educate our candidates how to properly interview with the Zoom and how to check their technology prior. It was interesting. We had an individual interview with a client who was doing fabulously. She was having problem with her connectivity. So she thought it would be in her best interest to turn off her camera, right, to help free up some bandwidth. Client called back and said, "Oh, you know what? She turned off her camera. We don't know why. Was she reading something? Was she unable to answer these questions?" And then looking at a cheat sheet, candidate's thinking to myself, "I just thought I was being courteous, that maybe this would improve our connectivity," right? So there's a great span of, you know, if your kid comes in the room, do you turn off your camera? And how does a client perceive that? Does that make sense? Like, we've had to educate our consultants very strongly on, it's better just to say, "I had bad connectivity. How would you like me to handle it? I have a child that's standing next to me. You know, can you give me one moment?" I think people probably react to the truth better than shutting off cameras and that type of business. On the client side, it's speed to market. What we find is getting three people set up on a Zoom, right? You would think that that would be easier on that side, and then connecting it to the candidate. So a lot of times I think our most successful clients are proficient in getting meetings set up, interviews set up. The purchase orders are already approved. They're ready to go. But onboarding today is a good 3 to 4 week process. And that's computers are getting shipped. Background checks are being delayed. We're dealing with marijuana, right? Recreational use of marijuana, just because it's legal in states, doesn't necessarily mean a company has to accept it. So we're starting to see a trend. We had our first company take marijuana off the drug panel. So I thought that was very interesting. We had another company say, if someone passes a drug test, they can start. The rest can trickle in when it wants. So companies are starting to adjust. We share these stories and everybody kind of plays their part. And those are the clients that I think will get the best human capital.
Absolutely. Yeah, those are definitely very interesting observations. And we could probably spend the rest of the podcast talking about this because it's so interesting. In terms of your content diet, the resources that you consume on a daily basis to keep yourself informed on the state of your industry, where, you know, the different trends and insights, share with us those.
So I'm an avid conference individual. I read my information from staffing, from SIA. Okay. I really believe the analytical portion of our industry is critical. I attend conferences because I believe that working with your peer network group, right, understanding what's available, understanding problems people are having, you know, sometimes it's much better discussed over a glass of wine. Let's not kid ourselves. You know, you sit down with someone, you start talking about issues, you hear what they're doing, you share what you're doing, and then somewhere in there, you guys come out, everybody comes out with a little bit more of information. I go to probably 5 to 6 conferences a year. I most likely will speak at 4. My goal is every conference that I go to, I bring back a new business partner. At this point in time, we have 24 business partners in our technical stack. And I came back from ASA and I have another one. So at this point in time, actually I have four, but this one will be a specific company that we will help build APIs and become adopted into the Bullhorn marketplace, which we do quite a bit of that.
That's exciting. Yeah, can definitely relate on the conference aspect of that. In terms of, you know, you've been in the industry for quite some time. You've had your great probably deal of share of mentors and coaches and career, just overall advisors. Talk to us a little bit from that perspective. And more importantly, what is one career advice or maybe a series of recommendations and advice that you continuously revert to yourself that you tend to share with others?
So I would say through my career, I've had four individuals, and each one has served its own purpose in my journey. I'm very fortunate the last 24 years here. I'll start with my largest mentor, or really my most influential mentor, is coming into this company at the age of 27 as a director of recruiting and then becoming the president. The mentor that I work for owns about 30-something companies. His father was the LBO king of Beatrice Foods, a very well-known family, and strong credentials. The interesting part of it is that when I first started here, he used to come into my office and he'd sit down and he'd say, "What's going on?" So naturally, I would just vomit whatever it was, however it was. And then in the middle of the conversation, I noticed at about 3 minutes, he'd get up and he'd walk out. And I'd be like, "What the heck? I wasn't done." For 3 years, he did this exercise with me, and he'd get up and he'd walk out. He'd get up and he walked out. And then I finally realized, am I really telling him what he wants to know? So during this time, I had this fabulous executive coach for about 15 years. And I learned very quickly, when someone asks me an open-ended question like that, what's going on? They already know what's going on. So my question back to him is, what is it that you want to know? Right? And so you start changing the dynamics of how you communicate to, you know, people who are really, really established. These aren't long conversations. So what is it you need from me? Let me tell you what you want to know. And then everybody goes on their way. So I've learned to be better at not getting sucked down that rabbit hole. As a woman, right, and having four major male mentors, I also learned very quickly that being busy and doing everything for everybody isn't necessarily the definition of a leader. I'm the type of person that everybody will come to. I could solve a problem. I can close any piece of business. You know, it was kind of funny. I'm like the cleaner, right? A problem happens. You go to the cleaner. Cleaner comes in, cleans it up, buries it, and everybody moves on. But what I realized through my career is that I was great as a cleaner, but was I really a leader, right? Was I capable of really coming up with creative concepts, being a visionary for an organization, bringing in resources and talent to really shift what it was that we were trying to accomplish and build? And that was a humbling journey for me. Because it was almost like through my career, I had to start over and start rethinking on how I valued even what my contributions were to a team. So it was a great learning journey. This executive coach, John Cundiff, probably was one of the most sobering people I had ever worked with in my life. And I encourage it, because it's really hard when you get to a very successful level to take a step back and realize you might not be what you really think you are, or perceive the way that you believe you are or you want to be. I had another manager who was a great mentor, who when I started, I had to learn how to make decisions, right? So when I first started, I'd call and call and call, and then I'd get offended like a day or two goes by. So what happens? I start making these decisions. Finally, after a few months, another one of my mentors, Steve Wolf, comes back to me and I said, Steve, why aren't you taking my calls? He said, because if I take your calls, then you're not going to make the decision. So
that's how
I learned, right? That's how I learned to make decisions, mm-hmm. is by somebody forcing me into that uncomfortable feeling of making decisions. And so that was a huge one. One of my mentors, Leo Sheridan, who I still get mentored by today, was my very first job. I learned that if I worked hard, I could wheel and deal for anything that I wanted. So it wasn't uncommon when we were building Motorola that I'd go over to him and he'd say, come on, come on, Anastasia, you can do this. Get 5 this month. What do you want? All right. If I get 5 this month, will you get me rollerblades? Absolutely. So I'd hustle and hustle and hustle. And I remember back at that time, we had like rolling paper fax machines. You had to get your ad in the newspaper by Friday by 5. Like internet was non-existent. You know, it was a 70-hour work week, but I got those rollerblades. You know, I found that if you work hard and you wheel and deal, you can move your trajectory in business. And so it was a lot of fun to be able to apply the training that I was provided through him and work my way through becoming a president and a business partner and owner, 20 something years later.
Mm-hmm. Right. Oh, that's super cool. And I appreciate you sharing all the kind of these very deep and thought provoking recommendations. Definitely resonates on so many levels. Anastasia, can't thank you enough for your time today. It was very short and insightful conversation. What I love doing with a lot of the guests on the podcast is do a follow-up recording in about a year where we revisit the conversation from a year ago and see if, you know, everything we've discussed still applies, still makes sense. So I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you as well.
Well, I hope that I'll be able to keep some millennials and Gen Zs here for that time period. So now we'll have a good measurement period of all these changes. We'll see if they actually work.
That sounds like a plan. Definitely thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, John.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.